Before you on the screen, you have the Jordan River Valley looking east toward Perea. And so once again, we did it this morning. You've got the Jordan flowing down here kind of out of sight. You can see the vegetation there. And then the mountains of Jordan, modern Jordan today, Moab, back in the day. It's just completely coincidental that we had similar pictures for the Bible class this morning. But as it is, we were studying Matthew 19. This is now Matthew 18 that we're going to be studying this morning. We've seen the five discourses of Matthew are very prominent in that gospel. And three of these we've already covered, the Sermon on the Mount, the apostolic missions, and the Sermon and Parables. So this morning we begin in chapter 18, these attitudes in the kingdom. And it's taking place just prior to Matthew 19. Jesus apparently made one last long journey. Had a lot of things that took place in it as he was coming down from Capernaum, there on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee that he'd made his hometown, working his way down the length of the Jordan all the way into the lowest place on earth there at the north shore of the Dead Sea. Would then pass through Jericho on his way up to Jerusalem, where he would be killed, even as we've just been memorializing it here in the Lord's Supper. I ran out of time pretty badly this morning. Felt real urgency trying to get through a lot of material, and so I failed to mention. This is just an addendum for those of you that are in the morning class. We did cover Matthew 19 this morning. We'll be covering it again in more detail this upcoming Sunday. And then, if you'd like, I've been speaking with some of you and getting some feedback. And I could see the wisdom in having maybe a feedback class prior to getting into 1 Corinthians 7, and then another one at the end of 1 Corinthians 7. So I particularly want to encourage everybody, as we're in Matthew 19 these 2 weeks, please, if you have questions, if you're concerned about anything, you think I've made a mistake there, you disagree in any way, if you would write me or send an email, send me a text, corral me somewhere in the building here, and get those questions to me so that I'll be able to prepare a class revolving around them, or at least find out if we'll need an entire class for that. But since Matthew 19 is so extremely critical, please bring those to me or get those to me, and we'll try to have an additional class then for more class participation 2 weeks from now. So we'll be looking at attitudes in the kingdom this morning, and then coming to the three chapters that deal with the coming of the Son of Man. That is the title phrase, if you will, for those chapters, the coming of the Son of Man in a judgment that's very dramatically and frighteningly described in some passages there in those three chapters. But for today, please come to chapter 18. And first thing you want to do, of course, just get the setting. In verse 1, the disciples came to Jesus and they said, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Now, I might recommend, if you don't already have parallel verses printed in a side column reference or some such in your Bibles, that you recognize there's an addition that's really pretty important, I think, that you'll find in Mark, but not in Matthew. In Mark, we have two words that are added. Mark says, "On the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest." So in Matthew's record, it sounds just kind of neutral and could refer to anybody. Mark helps us to understand in the parallel passage, this is a thing they've been arguing about and are therefore apparently coming to Jesus because they want him to resolve the great dilemma, which one of the apostles is the greatest. As a matter of fact, in Luke 9, verse 46, that'd be a second parallel verse reference you'd put there next to 18:1, an argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. And so Luke adds even another more emotional level, if you will. There's an argument that's going on. So where Matthew just says they asked who's greatest, in Mark they were discussing of them, and then Luke says they were having an argument about it. And so apparently it was fairly heated, or at least it was intense enough that they couldn't let it go. And so these disciples want to know, "Jesus, which one of us do you favor? Which one of us might have a higher station? Which one of us would be endowed with greater powers or responsibility or authority?" Now, this is the setting now for chapter 18. And I might suggest I mean that just the way I phrased it, not just for the next couple of verses, But throughout Matthew 18 now, what prompts this great discussion about attitudes in the kingdom of heaven, attitudes for the people that will be ruled from heaven, attitudes for the people that belong in a kingdom that God is ruling over. The very first thing, you know, that prompts all this is Jesus, you know, answering a question with a pretty bad attitude on the part of these disciples. I think, you know, all of us are well aware, well, this was a silly thing to be arguing about. Certainly no reason for any kind of strife to come among the 12, you know, over this. And they're sure missing the mark here, you know. This is just a sad failure and reflects very poorly upon them. But nonetheless, you know, that is then going to lead Jesus, I think, on down through the rest of the chapter to show how the people of God ought to think. Now, if you have been with us, I know you've got a number of visitors that I've seen in the audience here this morning. In recent lessons, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time pointing out, and it's a central part of the discussion of marriage and divorce and remarriage, that Jesus was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We are not to think he started the Sermon on the Mount, you know, by saying that he came to abolish or annul the law. Jesus is living under the law and he's teaching the law. And so for a lot of years, I think I was just missing, you know, a proper or maybe a more full understanding of this phrase, kingdom of heaven. And we talked about it again, but for, you know, you newbies, the kingdom of heaven, if you're thinking, as I used to, you know, long years ago, that the kingdom of heaven is when we go to heaven. So that the kingdom of heaven we're waiting for, we're not in it now, and we'll get there, you know, eventually. And when we go to heaven, well, then we'll see God as he is, Jesus as he is, with the Holy Spirit. We'll be able to enjoy, you know, a blissful eternity with them upon the throne. And so the kingdom of heaven is the great goal that we're to look forward to. Well, as years went by, I began to realize, well, no, you know, the passages are pretty plain. You're in the kingdom of heaven now, here on the earth. But for some time, I was thinking, well, that's right. You know, Jesus and God are our king, and they rule from heaven. So it's a kingdom ruled from heaven. But again, still, I was a little too limited. I'm thinking in terms of, well, it refers to Christianity then, but not anybody under the old law. You know, more recent studies, and very much came into sharper focus for me on our Wednesday nights in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy, there's always been a kingdom of heaven. God has always ruled from heaven. There's always been a heaven. There's always been a king in heaven. And whether you live before Moses' law or you live during Moses' law or you live after Moses' law, regardless, God has always sought people to be his children, to be citizens in his kingdom, and to have obedient, humble servants that would respond to the things that he taught. And so the kingdom of heaven can be thought of as a place I'm going to go. It can be thought of as the church. But, you know, it really, I think, in its broadest sense, it has to do with anybody at any time that has sought to please God with your thoughts, with your effort, with your stuff, to make the most of the life you have in service to a great king who has always ruled over the physical creation that he brought into being, and over the people that are responsive then to his will. For he has never left the children of this earth without instruction, without understanding. That instruction may have come in the form of the family traditions that would be passed down from Adam and Eve. It may have come in the time we think of as the patriarchs or the individual heads of the families. Abraham, most prominent among them, received information directly from God, revelation from God that could then be passed on. Moses, it became an extensive written law. But, of course, the Gentiles, not having the written law, were still under law. They were not abandoned. They were still receiving information from God, the most famous of which, of course, is Jonah, rather spectacularly, finding himself preaching in Nineveh. The Ninevites are not Jews. There's no Jewish captivity going on at the time. There aren't any Jews there at all. This is God communicating with the citizens of his kingdom. Ninevites could serve God. And those that repented affected the cessation then of the terrible threat that the whole city was going to be destroyed because they responded to the gospel, the good news of their time. So here we have a chapter now about attitudes, but also about behaviors. It's going to give the Jews advice that can be followed when you get into some kind of scrape with your brothers and sisters in Christ. It's going to be at information then that is of equal value to us, whether you're a Jew under the law, as the people are that Jesus is addressing here, or whether we become Christians, because these are general principles. They're principles that that reflect the wisdom of God and ought then to be recognized by us and practiced by us as such. So there's just this awful, you know, selfishness going on. There's this ranking going on, and there's this arrogance that's going on, and the argument, you know, they haven't been able to resolve. And so now we have these first five verses. And in these first five verses, you know, it's just wonderful that Jesus is going to use a child, somebody's child. Is it a boy? Was it a girl? I don't know. Some young human being, which all human beings treasure as the most valuable of all human beings. The cutest thing we could think of. Just warm our hearts, bring smiles, you know, to our faces. My youngest son, as you know, involved in virtual realities on the cutting edge of it. He and two friends had started a company that's a leader in virtual reality in the whole world today. They got installations all over various, you know, countries. And he's in a big show in Florida right now. And he sent me just the most heartbreaking photograph. And it's a series, actually, of two. And what it is, when you go to their thing, you know, there's a 40 by 40 foot square. You put these goggles on, and then there's a deal in the back that you know, twist, and it tightens them up. Now you cannot see anything in the real world, and then the headphones, you know, come down. Now you can't hear anything that's in the real world. And then through the computers, they pipe a virtual world into your senses. And it's really amazing, and it's really fun. And they had people lined up for 3 hours. For 12 hours, they waited 3 hours for a 3.5 minute thing. And then somebody brought a little girl. She couldn't have been more than about 3 or 4. And the first picture shows her all excited getting the headset on. And the second picture showed it tipped up on her head. She would go like this because it doesn't fit. So she can't play. He just breaks your heart. Disappointment in a child. You know, it just ruins your day. So it's sweet, but it's bittersweet. Anytime anybody calls a little child to their side and begins to interact with this rudimentary human being, you know, with this pure individual, in Ezekiel 18, we are told, and certainly the whole of the Old and New Testament makes it plain, they have no sin. Not even a consciousness of right and wrong. They have not eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil yet. But it's coming for them, suddenly in the form of the forbidden fruit for Adam and Eve, but now it's taught, as God asks us to, from infancy, what is right, what is wrong. But these little ones, they're not guilty of sin. They're not understanding these things. They don't choose to do evil. There is a primal purity at birth in a soul that can't conceive of sin. I understand it's also the most ultimately selfish thing on the planet. We'll lay that aside for a minute. You know, gimme, gimme, and gimme now, whatever I want, or you'll suffer for it. I understand that. But these needs are necessary, and they don't have language, and they don't have understanding. They're free from sin. So at this moment, this is the best picture I've ever found, and I didn't find it until I was preparing for this week. I've seen an awful lot of the artwork, you know, Jesus with a child. But that's got to be the best one. It just has to be. Jesus felt toward children like you and I do. Jesus could love them with a fullness, appreciate them with a depth that you and I just kind of glimpse. I get it, you know, they don't know sin yet, and we do. But this is the Son of the living God who knows no sin. And every time he calls one of these youngsters to himself, he finally has someone with whom he has ultimate and complete fellowship. These two are without sin. These two are innocent. These two are pure. And these two then are endowed by God from their birth with a nature that Jesus wants us to learn from. He tells us we got to turn back to that. Unless you can reclaim that somehow, unless you can remember and then relive what that is like, then there's problems. So let's read these next few verses. He called a child to himself. He set him before him. He said, "Truly I say to you, unless..." That's an exception clause. That's a conditional kind of a thing. Without this, there's going to be trouble. But unless you are converted and become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, brethren, beyond all doubt, the child that Jesus has now brought to himself and is exhibiting to these wrangling apostles who've missed the whole point in their selfishness, this child is in the kingdom. This child's in the kingdom of heaven. We get cast out of it when we sin. We need to get back into it now because of the blood of Christ. But we render ourselves unfit as servants of God when we sin. And apparently here there's no sin. And this is what Jesus is trying to call you and me back to. Call the apostles back to this in this immediate setting. He called the child. He set, it does say him. He set him before them. And he said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children," you've lost that, "you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." You guys are out of it right now. You're asking me who's greatest in the kingdom of heaven in verse 1. And I'm saying the way you're acting right now is not you, because you're not any of you in it. You're not like this child. Verse 4, "Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The apostles weren't asking who will be greatest in the heaven, in the kingdom of heaven. They're asking who is. This is all very much in the present tense. This is all a matter of they're thinking about their lives at this time. And Jesus is saying, you guys are showing conceit. And this child isn't doing that. This child didn't come to me with the question of, am I better than the rest of the babies around here? I can't imagine such a thing. And so there's just this wondrous moment when two pure beings stand there looking at these, you know, wrangling apostles, and Jesus says, you've got to get back to this. You've got to get back to this innocence. You've got to get back to this purity. You've got to get back to this humility. We laughed a little while ago. Children demand, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning that they be fed and they be clothed and changed and all these other things. But brethren, children sure enough are humble. It's only the failure of the parents who don't know how to discipline their children who find their children in charge. If your children are in charge, if they're running the show in your home, you've really missed the whole point. Children, by nature, and if properly taught by adults, are humble. They don't think of themselves as smarter than everybody else. They run to mommy and daddy to find out what's true. They know they're confused and don't know what decisions to make. So they run to daddy and mommy to ask, what should I do? They're not trying to exalt themselves over mommy and daddy. That doesn't come till the fifth grade. Then it comes with a vengeance. And not till then, not till they grow up and learn from parents how to be selfish, not till they have experience in the world where people mistreat them, and so they want to lash back and convince themselves that their way of thinking and the decisions they make are better than everybody else. But not when they're like this. And brethren, we lose this. and we lose the kingdom. And then Jesus dies for us so we can get back in. And then he says, when you get in, you start serving the Lord your God. You're conscious that you're a subject and not a Lord. You're conscious that you're a little one and not a big boss. When you understand that we're here to help each other, you know, which is another thing you often find. Children, I know, they grab things from each other. But the sweetest thing you'll ever see is when one child's trying to help another. He ain't heavy. He's my brother. How many of you remember that song? I'm getting old. Just huge that song was along about 1964, I think it was. And taken from apparently an actual event. One little guy was carrying another guy piggyback. Some adult saw it and looked down and said, well, that must be a really heavy load. And the child, in its innocence, probably not even connecting these two things, said, he ain't heavy. He's my brother. And then you realize, well, if you put those together just right, brothers and sisters are not burdens to be borne. They're in the same fellowship. They're in the same family. We're all in this together. And we need to be like that little guy carrying his brother. They're not heavy. That's my sister. That's my brother. So, 4, humbles himself as this child is greatest in the kingdom. You're not great because you seek it. You're not great because you're conscious of it. You're utterly unconscious of it, like this child. The great ones were the humble ones. And you apostles, you know, you just see Jesus going, shame on you. Shame on you. And at this moment, I have no doubt they get it too. Can you imagine how these guys must feel? How can you look at a little child and not just feel this outpouring of love? And how, you know, how can I spend more time and help out, you know, this individual? And as soon as Jesus spun that child around to look at them, and look here, they just must have been so mortified. This is powerful stuff. And it's so few words, you know, it's one of those object lessons. And really so very, very plain. So in verse 5, lastly, he says here on a positive note, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. If you go through your life conscious of the teachings of the Lord Jesus Christ, if you go through your life aware and alert to what the king in the kingdom has taught, what he says should be the way you conduct your affairs, then you will receive children. You'll spend time with children like he did. You'll enjoy children like he did. They're not a nuisance. They're not something to just be shunted off to the cry room. They are to be role models. And so, you know, we're trying to accept that kind of purity, because it is an innocence that precedes even the knowledge of right and wrong. So without that knowledge, they make loads of mistakes. And, you know, but it's a baby. So you don't smack them around. You just understand they don't know any better. You need to help them out. You need to teach. You need to accept. So when they spit up on you, then what? Well, you know, babies do that. Well, but it's my best suit. I got a couple of those. Spit up all over them. You know, but what? That's my son. And babies do that. And they'll grow out of it. So, brethren, the next time somebody in this congregation spits up on you, and you catch all that grief, just sit down and say, okay, you know, let's see, we can't get beyond this, you and me. All right? Don't take it personally. Don't say, I'm better and you're worse. Don't go running off to the elder, you're treating me bad. Brother, what's that about? Try to get back to the innocence and the purity. And you better be serious about it, because there's also verse 6 and following now. In verse 6 now, you know, the storm cloud rolls in. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me, to stumble. It's better for him that a heavy millstone be hung around his neck and he be drowned in the depth of the sea. So when you just thoughtlessly, carelessly, you know, have some little guy racing through the building and he trips, you know, or makes you stumble, and you immediately rise up in all your righteous indignation, you know, about how wrong that behavior is and what's the matter with the parents and all the rest of that. Brethren, first we're supposed to be receiving them, humble like them. But if you say or do anything that would frighten that child, that would make that child retreat, that makes such a child uncomfortable in the midst of God's people, makes a child unhappy in the family of God. Brethren, there's a millstone with your neck size and the depths of the sea waiting for you. Now, again, I'm telling personal stories this morning. You know, I once had a couple of kids who, like me, liked skateboards. So we bought the kids skateboards. One day, I went over to a church building, neighboring church, closest one to us. Preacher's there. I just want to meet with the preacher. And they had one of these daylight basement deals. So you had to go up a flight of steps to get to the main halls. But once you were inside, you had to go down a full 2 stories worth of stairs, you know, to get to the classrooms, which had little windows at ground level next to the parking lot. One of which one of our son's skateboard found right in the middle. Blam! Blew out glass in the office downstairs. And therefore, the preacher's office where, as I recall, you know, that preacher and I were. And that guy came boiling out of that chair and he raced up those stairs and he gave my kids what for. And they stood there just like that. You know, okay, yeah, you messed up. Now, I was going to say, raise your hand if you've never fallen off a skateboard. That could be a lot of people. I've never been on one either. But Brian, if you've been on a skateboard, you know they get away. And if you're on glass at ground level, it gets broken. And it costs you about $15 at the glass store to get it replaced. So what's the big deal? It's not like they went out there and said, I'm going to throw my skateboard through that window. It wasn't like that. You know, and so brethren, look. Do you know, to this day, my children say, I don't like that preacher. And I think I know where it started. I think it started with a riot act that got read to them in a parking lot when they were along about 3rd grade. That's where I think that got started. And brethren, first impressions are hard to get over. So why are you leaving unhappy ones with anybody? And not with children. Just ever. And deal with it. Now I'll admit, brethren, I think the dumbest thing I've ever seen a parent do was let a child fly a drone inside a church building with 100 people in it. There's something wrong with that parent. It's just spectacular. How dumb can you get? But is it the kid's fault? Well, I guess not. What does he know? Dad said I could. Well, Dad's a moron. But I didn't tell him that. This parent is failing you spectacularly. But you didn't tell him that. What do we do? Well, you go out in the foyer where he can't get at you through the double doors with the drone. But you don't want to stumble. You don't want to cause the kid to stumble. Brethren, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me. That's why we start these classes so young. Kids just drink it in, don't they? They're not fighting it. They're not questioning it. They're trusting you. That's faith. To tell them the truth. So they just believe it. Because that's what children do. Causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble is better for him than a heavy millstone be hung around his neck, that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. For it's inevitable. The stumbling blocks come, but woe to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. Throw it from you. It's better for you to enter life crippled. Now, this is that kingdom of heaven thing. This is Jesus teaching Jews again. So whatever you may have thought about this before, it's not talking about going to heaven. It's talking about being in a life where you're crippled. It's better for you to enter life crippled or lame than having two hands or two feet, which we're not going to have in heaven, to be cast into the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. Throw it from you. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into the fiery hell. Yeah, let's go here. 6 and 7. Those who believe in me, and the punishment is severe. Okay, now I got to get caught up here. Do you guys remember this event? 2015, on the Hungarian-Serbian border, a Hungarian reporter was watching a group of Syrian, not Serbian, but Syrian refugees try to cross over their border. That's an illegal immigration moment. And this reporter for Hungary, whose border they were coming into, saw this young father carrying his son coming at her. You remember what she did? The whole group was surrounded by cameras. It was all over the news. So she stuck out her foot and she tripped that dad. And they went down like that. They had it on 6 different cameras. What did she do? She made a little one stumble. Now, how do you react to that? Well, everybody does. Well, I don't care about illegal immigration and whether they're from Syria, Serbia, Hungary, or Alaska. That's not the way to behave, is it? You're a reporter. What's this about? In case you think that's some kind of accident, she got caught doing it again with a little girl this time. What happened? She instantaneously lost her job. And then, politely, they say she left public service. Reed went into hiding. Okay? Because there are about 400 million people on the surface of the earth that wanted to kill her. Okay? You don't do that. You just don't. So, these who believe in me, you trip up, the punishment would be very severe, and you need to avoid causing them to stumble, the stumbling, at all cost. Millstones, fiery Gehenna, eternal fire. Okay? Stay away from Stay away from all of this as far as you possibly can, because judgment, brethren, certainly is coming. Now, I know, and especially for the visitors, this is driving crazy, but we've been talking about this quite a lot, this fire, this eternal fire and the fiery Gehenna. The word is not hell in our classically styled eternal torment at all. It's a valley that's on the east and south side, west of Jerusalem. And I just can't get into all of that, you know, at this time. When we get to 23, 24, and 25, though, we will. For those who have already been here, they understand where I'm going. For those of you that don't, I'm just suggesting that this is all about the fall of Jerusalem. It's all about the end of the Jews and Mosaic law. It's about being killed and thrown into Gehenna and not about eternal torment. Now, those that wound up in this eternal fire and fiery Gehenna, I mean, they're going to spend eternity destroyed. I grant that. But that's not the figure in the way it's used. So we'll come back to all of that later. Just at this point, you know, let's just get the end in 10 and 11. So that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you, their angels in heaven continually behold the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which is lost. And again, I'm going to take a lot of time on guardian angels. This sermon is over. But there are guardian angels, and we don't know what they do. Jesus said there are, and we don't know what they do. And so we're not given any information about it in Scripture. Just know that when you're messing with a child, there's a guardian watching everything you do. That ought to give you pause the next time a skateboard comes flying through the window into your office. Okay, that ought to give you pause. Now, is this about babies only? What started this discussion? Why did Jesus bring the child? Why all this talk about these children? So that you don't do this to adults. That's what children become. So that you don't ever do this. Woe be to those through whom the stumbling blocks come, regardless of the ages. Jesus is trying to say, you can't get away with spitting up on your 30-year-old brethren either. Okay? Just don't spit up on anybody, is what Jesus is trying to say. Be like the child that believes in me, is humble, open, receptive, innocent. Get back to that. And don't you ever do anything that makes the life of a kingdom member harder. Not before Moses, not during Moses, not in Christianity, not ever should you make somebody else's way harder. And if you're tempted, then think of them as a little child, and maybe it'll turn you back. Because you need to be converted and become like a child if you want to remain in the kingdom of heaven forever. Go and do thou likewise.